Hello there, I'm Ed Butler and welcome to Business Daily from the BBC. Coming up, Britain's imminent departure from the EU. How a hard Brexit might hurt both the UK and Europe.
The exit process as such is painful enough. I mean, if you really want to make it look miserable, it's going to be terrible for us as well. And so our life as well is going to be worse.
Also in the programme, some special advice from South Korea. What to do when your dog dies?
So what we recommend is to first wrap the body in a wet, let's say, a bathing towel, and then put them inside the fridge.
The business of cloning from Business Daily and the BBC. Britain, we learnt last week, is just months away from launching itself on the formal process of leaving the European Union. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, has set a date for the procedure known as Article 50, which means that Britain will be out entirely by March 2019. The British people did, of course, vote in a referendum to leave the EU in June. The Prime Minister has also set out some tough terms, including a pledge to curb the flow of EU citizens entering the UK. More than 2 million of them currently work in Britain. That hasn't gone down well with many EU politicians who regard free movement as a key principle of membership. And the pound has since plunged amid fears that Britain will be forced out in disarray. Up till now, the economic fallout has been small for Brexit, but could that be about to change for both Britain and possibly the EU as well? Guntram Wolf is the director of the Bruegel think tank in Brussels.
I personally think we can have a deal with UK being outside of the European Union, still trading a lot with us, doing a lot of economic activity with us, but with some limits on migration. I think the EU is very sort of tough on that line, and I do think that ultimately there is a line for a compromise there. Now, what is not possible is to really have deeply integrated markets without enforcement of common rules, because if you don't have that, you really have unfair competition. You don't have a level playing field. You get major distortions, and you know, basically companies can free ride from one area of the market without playing by the rules, and that's just not acceptable.
One of the arguments, of course, by those supporting Brexit during the referendum campaign was that it made no sense. It would make no sense for the European nations to be so hard on Britain when a large chunk of their trade is with the UK. It's a very important trading partner to other members of the EU.
Well, look, I think we have to be realistic here on the negotiating strengths, the relative negotiating strengths. I mean, for the UK, more than 40% of the exports go to the EU, while for every individual EU country, I mean, the trade is no more than 10-15% of your exports. So clearly, if we go down a nasty trading war, which I think we should, both sides, we should prevent, but if we were to go down that such a war, I think it would be much more painful for the UK than for the EU.
Is this an economic argument, do you think, or is it pure politics? Punish Britain as a deterrent to other would-be leaver countries?
No, I think that's the wrong attitude, quite frankly. I mean, we have to be a union where countries stay because they like to stay and because it is attractive to stay. Now, being outside, I think, has disadvantages, but punishing is certainly the wrong attitude. And I think that is not unanimously understood on this side of the channel. But I think really we need to be reasonable. We need to come to a compromise that is not too destructive. And quite frankly, even a destructive deal would not prevent others from leaving. What prevents others from leaving is really good conditions of being inside the European Union.
Yes, and a sign that if you leave, it's going to be miserable. I mean, if you're looking at, if you're taking the view, let's say, of François Hollande, for example, and you want to deter people from voting for Marine Le Pen and the far right in France, you want to show them that the British are having a really tough time and everything's terrible on our side of the channel.
Well, look, I think the exit process as such is painful enough. I mean, if you really want to make it look miserable, it's going to be terrible for us as well. And so our life as well is going to be worse. So really, I think it's a matter of degree. And I mean, the UK is still going to do better than, let's say, Italy, that has had zero productivity growth. So it's miserable compared to now, but still perhaps better than Italy. So I think that logic doesn't really work to the extent some of the leaders on this side would like it to work.
Quick final thought. Some people are saying that Britain, you know, now threatens, the signs are from the pound, that Britain could face recession next year if things do get very tough. Is there an economic risk to Europe here? I mean, there are a lot of other pressures on Europe right now in terms of its unity.
Well, look, I think so far the European economy has weathered the shock of Brexit really quite well. I mean, GDP is keeping up nicely. Growth rates are actually as high as they haven't been for quite some time, almost 2% year on year. So we are in a relatively strong position at this stage. But it is true, a major recession in the UK and a drop in trade and so on, all of this would weigh on our economy. So indeed, I think we should not prevent sort of an extremely bad outcome for the interest, really, quite frankly, of both sides, and in particular, really, of the citizens and the workers on both sides.
The thoughts there of Guntram Wolf of the Bruegel Institute, a think tank in Brussels. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with me, Ed Butler. As incomes rise around the world, more and more money, gets spent on pets. The industry has a concept it calls pet humanization. In other words, get people to think of their pets as family, so they spend more money on them. If you think your dog is really a baby, you're more likely to buy a coat for it in winter. In South Korea, they're taking this a step further. It is one of the world leaders in cloning technology, so that people from all over the world are now going there to try to recreate their deceased or soon-to-be-deceased pets. The BBC's Steve Evans has slipped on his lab coat to watch the latest canine delivery.
In a laboratory in Seoul in South Korea, a puppy is born. This is Suam Biotech, where for $100,000 you can get your pet replicated. There is demand out there. Laura Jakes talks about her boxer dog Dylan as though it's human.
We just had such a close relationship. Ever since I got him, I dreaded the day that I'd lose him, because he was just my world. I fell in love with him straight away. I probably treat him a bit too much, but like a child. I think I just put so much love into him. I don't think I'll ever love anything like I love Dylan.
And then?
Dylan died. One night I had a couple of seizures just out of the blue. We went to take him for an MRI scan because boxers can be quite prone to brain tumours when they reach age 8. The MRI scan showed that it had a large inoperable brain tumour. Then within 19 days, he just died unexpectedly. It was really, really traumatic. I felt like he was just ripped from me.
I can't put into words what Laura was like when Dylan died. She was the wreck. She was so upset. It was unbelievable how she was. And I would have done anything to get her out of that. And that's why we decided to have a go at trying to clone Dylan.
Richard, Laura's partner, acted. They got in touch with the laboratory here in South Korea. There are guidelines about what to do if your pet dies, according to the cloning company's Jae Wong Wang. Should it be frozen, for example?
The cloning process would need a living cell. So that means if you freeze the body, all the water molecules inside the body are going to crystallize and rupture all the cells. So in fact, you're killing all the cells by freezing. So what we recommend is to first wrap the body in a wet, let's say, a bathing towel, and then put them inside the fridge. So it's 5 degrees Celsius.
And what's the time frame? How long have they got before they get that carcass to you?
The golden window for obtaining a healthy living cell is between 5 to 7 days after death.
And all you need is a bit of that dog, a small bit of flesh, or hair, or skin, or what?
So it depends on what state the dog is. Sometimes clients call before the dog has passed away. In that case, we just need a very small skin biopsy, let's say the size of a small coin. Now, when the companion is dead, then the chances of getting a healthy cell is much smaller, so we ask for a lot more. And these are cells from the skin and cells from the muscle. However, oftentimes we get a lot of requests if we can clone something out of a hair or from a saliva. But in fact, the cells present in hair or saliva don't last very long. And hair itself doesn't contain the cells. Only the bottom, the root of the hair, contains the cells.
And $100,000, and to a lot of people they'd think, that's a lot of money.
We like to put it as a price of a very nice car.
A very nice car.
Yeah. A very nice car. If somebody can afford a very nice car, then I guess they could also afford a psychological alternative to letting the companion go.
The cell of the dead animal is then grown, so it replicates until a fetus can be implanted in a surrogate mother. A copy of the original animal is created and then born. The clone is a physical replica, though it may still have different mental characteristics, just as two identical twins can. Attitudes to dogs are changing in South Korea. The Seoul Dog Show is a big event, and in a country better known for eating dogs rather than showing them off. Across the world, rising prosperity is expanding the market for products to cater for pampered pets. The Suam Laboratory was set up by one of the pioneers of cloning science. Jay Wung Wang says the company clones commercially in order to finance more fundamental scientific research. He accepts that cloning isn't cheap.
A lot of the time our clients really do go through great measures to get the money they need. Not all clients are super rich. They actually can afford it, but they're often put into a situation where they might have to liquidate some of their assets, for example, their car.
Do you make a lot of money?
Soon.
So, is it worth it? Richard and Laura were lucky. They got two cloned puppies from the one original. But they have big questions to answer. How to pay the bill, and what to call the new dogs.
The first puppy that's just been born, we're going to name him Chance. I think it's quite an appropriate name, and it's also the name of the dog out of my all-time favourite Disney film. And then when we found out about the second puppy, in the end we've decided on Shadow, out of the Disney film Homeward Bound. The other dog in the film, there's two dogs, and the other one's called Shadow.
It's $100,000. And I've had to do some serious juggling about to make this happen, but it had to be done, and it's worked. I can honestly say it's $100,000 well spent. I feel over the moon. We've got some financial juggling to do when we get home, but it's all worth it.
There is, it seems to me, a bigger question here. What is appropriate spending on animals in a world of human suffering? Last year, Americans, for example, spent $60 billion on pet products, more than twice the budget of USAID, the agency to help the world's poor people. And $100,000 to clone a dog? I wonder if it's good use of money.
Stephen Evans in Seoul with a remarkable slice there of modern life. So would you spend $100,000 on replicating a pet? Perhaps you're asking yourself, who cares? I mean, it's hardly an issue of global significance, is it? But here's a question. Whatever you think rationally about Steve's story, isn't the image of two cloned boxer puppies likely to be the only part of today's show that you actually remember long term? Do we prefer what you might call the trivial in life? Lucy Kellaway of the Financial Times has been reflecting on this.
An acquaintance who works for a bank emailed me to tell me that in an idle moment he'd been looking at his company's intranet site and noticed something odd. His chief executive's post about company profits had attracted 8 likes, while one about a new vending machine on the 6th floor had got 197. "I thought you'd enjoy that," he said. "I did enjoy it, but didn't find it odd in the slightest. I've long known that corporate employees were irredeemably trivial. A colleague who for years was the Financial Times managing editor once told me that by far the most unpopular thing she ever did, more so than making people redundant, was axing free coffee and superior biscuits that used to be delivered on Thursday mornings. Try this test. Ask anyone in your office how much money your company made last year. I bet they won't have the foggiest idea. I just texted a friend who for the past 20 years has occupied increasingly senior positions at the same company and put the question to her. Her reply came back, "Haven't a clue." This surely is a version of Parkinson's law of triviality, which states that the time we spend thinking about something is in inverse proportion to its importance. In Parkinson's example, a committee spends 3 minutes approving the construction of a nuclear reactor and then 45 minutes over a bike shed. His conclusion was that we dwell on the trivial because we understand it, while we shy away from the complicated because we're out of our depth. Just as I was thinking this, my friend sent me another text. And I don't care either. I looked at the message and it occurred to me that I'd got it wrong. Her reluctance to engage with how much money her employer makes wasn't that she doesn't understand or that she's trivial or stupid. She was being perfectly rational. She doesn't need to know what her employer's P&L looks like, so long as it's healthy enough not to affect her job. She works for a multinational and her contribution doesn't affect the overall profit one way or another. Equally, to care a lot about a new snack dispenser makes every sense. For a start, it has direct implications for what you can eat. It also suggests that the company is not about to go bust, as it's making a discretionary investment. You could say that we have a duty as responsible corporate citizens to take an interest in the finances of the organisations we work for. But I'm not sure we do, given we only stay in jobs for as long as it suits us. And given we could jump ship and join the competition at any time, there's no point in feeling proprietorial about what our company does in general. There's a lesson here for top management. Unless you can show that a post on global strategy is as relevant as a vending machine, there's no point in making it. This is Lucy Kellaway for the BBC World Service.
And I'm Abe Butler, back tomorrow looking at Nigeria's economic woes. Join me then.